Hello, everybody. This is Bethany, not Matt. Don't be too bummed out, but you know, he's making me do some of these things too. I gotta get everyone excited for the episode. Today, it's pretty awesome. We're hearing Matt's story. He talks a lot about some drug addiction as a teenager, suicide awareness, how to deal with an unexpected pregnancy, and how he found meaning and purpose at the end of all this. There's a lot of info and a lot of wisdom coming from Matt today, so I hope you guys all listen up. Hello, and welcome to the Finding Strength podcast. My name is Bethany Tenney. I am the therapist for the day, and we are going to be interviewing Matt Quackenbush.
That's me. In case you didn't know, I'm on this podcast too.
Yes.
And I'm going to be... Bethany's literally right now. So we're in my office, my home office where I do therapy. Bethany's literally sitting in the chair that I sit in to do therapy, and I'm sitting while my clients sit.
On the couch. I don't know how I feel about this. This is going to be awesome.
I'm excited.
So I guess we got to do a recap. Last week was Sete. Hope you guys all enjoyed that. That was so awesome to hear his story and hear what he does and kind of just get a little bit into who Sete is.
Yeah, his story blew a lot of people's minds. Like I said in the little description thing there, what that guy does day in and day out.
That takes a special person,
it
for
really
sure.
Does. Oh yeah, he's strong guy, strong heart. Got a lot of really good feedback from that one. I know a lot of people liked his story. So actually, I hope we can get set down again in the future and kind of hear a little bit more of his story, more about what he does and get into the nitty gritty a little bit. I think people might like that.
Oh, for sure. And then to hear him say how he just looks at everybody else like they're good people. I'm like, that's incredible.
I can't do that.
I'm working on it every day. So today, the plan is everyone got to hear my story. Everyone got to hear me cry. Matt's turn.
Are you going to make me cry? Is that your goal? It's not a very lofty goal. I'm a crier.
We get to hear who is Matt Quackenbush. So Matt, tell us who you are. Just a little bit about your job, your family, that kind of thing.
So what do you want me to start at the beginning? Do you want me to start like from birth?
First tell us who you are. Like,
okay. So I am a certified social worker by professional title. That's how I would identify myself first. But I think more importantly, the thing that's most important to me in my life is family. Husband, father, lover.
Yes.
I do a lot of soul searching. That's kind of my thing. Like, I've been a really deep thinker since I was a little tiny kid. And I've always been very empathetic. It's just like a gift, if that's a thing or whatever. I don't know. It's just something that naturally just is part of who I am. And because I'm able to be empathetic, naturally, I became a therapist. I worked for about 7 years at a place called Telos in Orem. I started there in 2007. Is that right? 2007, and I worked with troubled youth. It's a treatment center for kids. They stay there for about 10 months, and I fell into that job. Brindy helped me find that job. My sister was working there first, and I kind of fell into that job, and it just was like a home for me. I really found a lot of value and strength in helping people.
Okay, so you say treatment center, but what, drugs... Substance abuse, yeah. Kind of thing?
Both of those.
Eating disorders, what
some
kind of
eating
things?
Disorder stuff.
Okay.
So this first one that I worked at, yeah, they're troubled teenage boys.
Okay.
And there was anywhere, it depends on what period of time I worked there. There's at the end, it was like 50 kids that lived there. And they lived in this residential treatment center. They lived there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for, on average, 10 months. And their parents pay a crap ton of money. We're talking $10,000 a month. It's a lot of money to live there. So it's for the super rich. Which was interesting. That'll play into my story well. And then people who are really desperate, right? People who mortgage their homes to send their kids there.
Whatever
they
can
have
do.
To do it. And so I found these kids, and I've always been really good with kind of connecting to teenagers because my story goes back to my teenage, life. And that's when I really fell away from, I think, who I was. I think I knew who I was as a kid more than most people do, because I loved to help people as a child. Like, I was the kid that in elementary school, I went and sat with the kid. One of my best friends had a wheelchair, and I would just hang out with the kids in the wheelchairs and the handicapped kids, and I like help them eat their lunch. Like, that's what I did in elementary school.
That's awesome.
And so that was just kind of who I was and what I found value in as a child, like a young child. And then I kind of grew out of that, I guess, around middle school years, where I tried to be like popular and cool.
Yeah.
And eighth grade, I kind of fell in with a different crowd. And it was a crowd of people who I really connected with, for sure.
But why do you think you connected with them?
Because they were exiled, more or less. Exile is probably the wrong word. They just were, they were different, and I got that.
Rebellious different?
Yeah, rebellious different. Okay. Music was a huge part of my life. Always has been. Mm-hmm. Being that really emotionally, like, empathetic, deep-feeling person that I am.
Yeah, music, like the energy from the music.
Yeah, music moves me a lot. And so I played a lot of music growing up. So I met these guys that I was in the band with. I play the drums and guitar and piano and all sorts of different instruments. Anyway, so these guys were really into music, and we became really tight. And then all through high school, just had this really, really tight group of friends who I just loved. They were great people, and we partied.
Great. Hard. I was going to say great people, but did society look at them as great people, or is that you know. Just saw how great they were?
I don't know. I would say probably not.
Because they're teenage partiers, so yeah. That's wild sometimes children. Tough, yeah.
Wild children. Yeah, we weren't like the popular crew, per se. And we kind of didn't care, I think, which was kind of unique to teenage kids. Early on, that was definitely what I wanted. I wanted to be like one of the cool kids. But then once I found my home, I guess you could say, with these guys, we just loved music and loved to party and have fun. And do a bunch of drugs.
I was going to say, so at what age, what point in your life did you start to do drugs?
I started smoking weed. That was kind of the big thing in my sophomore year of high school. It was that summer, freshman to sophomore year. And then that became a big part of my life, kind of underground for years and years, all through high school into my early college years. And it was like this enhancer for me to feel more deeply. It was like a spiritual thing. Mm-hmm. I got into other substances and stuff too, a little more wild and crazy. Never like heroin or like meth or anything like that, but that was never a thing that interested me. But more just like stuff that can make me feel really deeply, mm-hmm. and like have these experiences and learn about myself and understand the human connection.
Which is so different. Yeah. Like, don't you think? I look at drugs, alcohol type of stuff, and I would say most people use them to go numb or to not feel. So the fact that you wanted to take them to feel deeper, that's interesting to me, because I don't feel, and especially for a teenager, I don't think teenagers want to feel a lot of times.
Yeah, I think part of it for me was maybe some of that. And maybe that's just the story that I told myself that I didn't.
That made you feel better about it?
Maybe. I don't know. I've never.
So how many years were you into that, to the drug scene?
4 or 5 years.
Okay.
Yeah, sophomore, junior, senior, freshman in college, so 4 years. And then I went on a mission for the Mormon Church, which was really cool. It was actually a really cool experience. Like, I loved it.
Where'd you go?
I went to Argentina.
Okay.
Served well there, had a good time, was really successful and on my mission. I kind of turned a corner, I guess you could say. Like, I like stopped my old life cold turkey and like started this new life.
Did you stop your drug and that type of thing to go on a mission? Yeah. Or was it before that? Was that, you're like, I'm going to stop doing this because I'm going to go serve a mission
now? Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Because I had a best friend who we kind of mirrored each other. We did everything together. His name was Darren. He's probably listening to this right now. What up, Darren? His story is interesting too, actually. We might get him on the podcast one of these days. And we did a lot of fun stuff together. And he went off to Hawaii to go to school. And I came up here to Utah to go to school. And kind of lived similar paths, I guess. I got way, way, way into music. Like, became my life. As in, like, failed out of college practically.
I was going to say, is this before or after Mission?
Before Mission.
Okay.
So we're in ninth grade now. Ninth, sorry. Freshman year of college. I apologize.
Okay. 13th so you're grade. Past high school. Okay.
Yeah. Sorry. I'm jumping all around here. Anyway. So yeah, 13th grade, freshman college, met a bunch of cool people up here. I moved in with my grandparents. I went to Weber State for a year, played music there. I was there on a music scholarship. Thought that's what I wanted to do. Studied music and still was into partying and the kind of the drug scene, if you will, but it was less than it was in high school for sure. And then my friend was off at school and he decided he wanted to go on a mission.
And you're like, okay.
I was like, sure, why not? I'll freaking go on a mission. It's cool. And that's kind of what we do in my family. Like, you just go on a mission.
Yeah, it's like the next step.
Yeah, it's an expectation more or less. And so I went, cool experience, came home, had 18 months. I met some really cool guys on my mission, really cool friends. Came home, lived with them. And that time was a weird time for me because I think the thing about that time is I was in this like identity crisis of what I wanted to do and who I wanted to be, because music had always been my thing and who I was and like what I really, really loved to do. And then I remembered more or less that I really liked helping people and like I wanted to make people better versions of themselves. I think I found that on the mission for the Mormon Church. And after I did that, came back, that became more of like what I wanted to do. And so I just kind of naturally fell into Telos, the place I was talking about before with these kids. And my wife now, Brindy, helped me find that. But before we got to Telos, it was rough for me and Brindy at the start. Like our story begins very rough.
I was going to say, before we get into the Brindy story.
Yeah.
I have a question. I just, coming from a religious family. And you talk about your party years and being a teenager doing those things. What kind of maybe division did that create between you and your family? Because that's a tough thing when you come from a family that's not okay. And that's not the norm, I guess. At least it wasn't in my family. If you were doing that stuff, you were like a little bit of an outcast.
Yeah.
Is there a lot of shame that comes along with that coming from such a religious background?
For sure. Yeah, it was something that I had to deal with big time. I kind of kept it underground, if you will. Like,
so it was more secretive?
Yeah, for sure. Like, it wasn't this overt thing that I was doing all the time. Like, it didn't really define me, like, being the party guy. Like I said, music was my thing. It was to enhance the musical, whatever, the artist in me.
So you weren't necessarily what we would have called a stoner, where everybody, eyes are bloodshot, everyone knows what you're doing all the time. Okay, so it's more just like a random, here and there, no one really knows, just your friends.
Okay, so one of the things I think, and maybe this is just my experience, but like, that's just what you did in high school. Like, people you partied, you had fun, you went around, you played, you were a child.
Yeah.
And that's a way that a lot of
testing things out. You're
play. Yeah.
And it didn't mean you were going to become a drug addict as an adult. And it didn't mean that you're going to become this loser in life. Mm-mm. It was just, it's experimenting. It's, whether or not that's dangerous, everyone can say for themselves. But I think as a teenager, it's kind of what we do.
For sure.
You're dabbling in different things, whether it's what you're going to be as a career or maybe some drug alcohol situations. Sure. And anyways, so in the overall scheme of things, did not negatively affect your life.
At that point, no.
Okay.
As a kid, no, because the consequences for doing that stuff as a kid, if you can more or less keep it well managed, they're minimal. But when you become an adult and you get back from a mission, And
you're still wanting to do those same things.
And you're still kind of trying to figure out like your life and how that all works for you. That becomes some sort of like, this dual world that you end up living in. And so that's just something that I've battled with, you know, on and off for a long time. And even my early years of my marriage and stuff like that. Like, there were points during our marriage where I would drink and Brandon didn't know. And I was hiding it from her.
Right? Yeah.
And there were points in our where I was with my friends in college and I would drink and they wouldn't know. And that to me, that's more scary.
When you're hiding it, when you're not being you.
Right. And that was to numb. That wasn't to enhance anything. That wasn't to make life better. That was, as a kid, it was fun. As an adult, I'm confused. I'm kind of lost with who I am because I hadn't found like the telos thing yet. I didn't know who I was. I didn't know how life, I don't know what to do with myself.
Well, and you know, you say an adult, but sometimes I think it's funny that we call an 18-year-old an adult.
That's true.
Because I have an 18-year-old and I'm like, what? He's not. He cannot make all these decisions. Uh-uh. This isn't real.
It wasn't good.
Okay, so what age did you meet Brindy?
I met Brindy at 24.
Okay. Yep. Tell just a little bit about, I mean, I know this story, but tell me a little bit about the story so everyone else can know.
This is such a fun story. So I get to tell this to everyone.
I love this story.
Actually, this story to me is where, for the first time, I think I had to step up and to tie in like the drinking and drug and stuff. That stuff had to step aside and I had to like be a man.
You figured out what was the most important.
Yeah. I figured out who I was, and it wasn't by chance. It was the universe, God, whatever.
You're in
showing me who I was.
Yeah.
So I'm 24 years old. Came out of kind of a weird relationship, and then I met Brindy, and we hit it off like instantaneously. There was like this intense chemistry. Emotionally, spiritually, physically, and very early on, we became kind of hot and heavy as far as like our physical connection, and I got her pregnant 6 weeks after we met.
Yeah, so pretty quick into the relationship.
Yeah, we didn't mess around.
No,
and it wasn't. On purpose.
No. I mean, you don't think about, wait, a baby can come out of this?
No.
Tell me what teenager that thought crosses their mind.
No, it was not on purpose, for sure.
And then so you...
And she was 19 and I was 24.
You've been dating 6 weeks. You have a baby coming.
Well, I didn't know she was pregnant, but like, we didn't know she was pregnant until she was like 10 weeks. So we'd been dating for several months.
Okay. But at the same time, even still, 3 or 4 months of dating... You're still young.
Babies.
And then it's like the typical, do we keep it?
Yeah.
Do we get married? Do we not get married? How did that process go through your head?
It was excruciating. The decision-making at that point as a 24-year-old child to just have to step up and be like, listen, this isn't about me. This isn't about her. This is about... a family. And it's not even about a kid anymore. And that was something that I figured out, I think, at a young age, because 24 is young. It's just like, listen, dude, talking to myself, like, you have to be the guy that supports a family or get out of here. Like, you're not going to bail on her, but...
Or give the baby up? Is that your thought?
Well... And this is tougher to talk about because I think if Brindy were here, she would have a hard time talking about this. And I kind of do too, but there's a lot of pressure.
But it's the reality this is what happens to people. If you're having a baby, you've got pressure from your parents. You got pressure from her parents. You've got pressure from any type of
grandparents.
I mean, I'd say any type of even a religious institution. Friends are like, what are you doing? You know, I mean, there is a lot of pressures.
It was so lonely. Not only, dude, there's so many things that happened during this time. I, at this time also, I had lost my apartment because my friend got married and I didn't have a place to live because I was just so wrapped up in all the shit that was going down. Mm-hmm. Like it was just chaos and I was just swirling or spiraling. And I remember, so I actually lived in the storage unit where we stored all of our band gear.
That's awesome. That's really safe.
It was very safe. So I was legit homeless for a while. And there was a dark point after Brindy was going to have the baby where I remember sitting in the band space and I wasn't high or drunk or anything like that. I just remember sitting there just thinking, you know what? She's probably going to be a better mom than I would be a dad. She's probably, they'd be better without me. And I literally for like hours thought about how I was going to kill myself.
See, and that's, I think we all do that to ourselves at some point in our lives. How did you pull yourself out of that and say, regardless of what I'm thinking, either switch your thought process or regardless of what I'm thinking, I'm not going to do that.
I don't even know if there was anything that I did. And it wasn't even like a moment where I was like, no, that's stupid. It was just, I don't know why. I just didn't do it. Because I knew there was some reason that I was on earth. I was here. Like, I've always felt like I have like a purpose, mm-hmm. like a meaning. And I didn't forget about that in that moment. It was more just like, I don't matter enough. And so I shouldn't be here anymore.
I just think there are so many, and I can tell you honestly, myself included, I have definitely had those moments where you're like, you know what? I'm making it worse. I'm making this harder. Without me, they can do it. They can get along without me. They can handle this. And it's such an awful thing to think because the truth of it is, no, everybody matters.
That's never the case.
No. And nobody is better off without any specific person in their life. It doesn't matter. Nobody is better off without these people.
And knowing what I know now, as you know, after being educated and working with suicidal persons for years, I get why the brain does that. And it's basically the ultimate fight or flight mechanism, mm-hmm. where there's a part of our brain that's there to keep us alive. It's the survival part of our brain. And once that part of our brain starts to kind of flip the script on us, basically what happens is normally fight or flight means I'm going to fight my problems or I'm going to run away from my problems. This is this ultimate act of flight, ultimate desperation where my problems are because of me. They're not making me worse. I'm the problem yeah. now and I need to run away from me and take my own life. And so I think that dark moment helped me gain more empathy for the people that I work with than almost any other. Mm-hmm. But there were definitely several dark moments in that time period that were really, really rough. And I felt very alone.
And how long is this time period? So from when you knew she was pregnant till you got married. Let's just go there first. Horrible. How long was that?
We got married in February. And we had the baby in May. We had Ezra in May.
How did you navigate through the pressures and maybe the comments, the harsh things from everyone outside of you and Brindy?
My aunt helped a lot. My aunt was my dad's sister.
She was like your second mom.
Yeah, she was awesome. And I'm kind of like her pseudo son. Because before all this, my cousin died. And he was my best friend.
I was going to say, he was not just your friend. He was like a brother.
Yeah, we did everything together. And before I met Brindy...
What age were you when he got sick?
I was 22. This is right after I got back from my mission.
Okay.
I was 22 years old. And
so he was the same age?
He was just a little bit older than me. His birthday was in October. I was in June. And you know, we'd been together since birth, family vacations, every Christmas, and we talked all the time. We would hang out for weeks on end. We partied together. We did everything together. Me and this guy, we were so tight. He was literally like the best friend you could ever have.
Mm-hmm.
And 22 years old, you know, so before I went on my mission, he was diagnosed with cancer, melanoma. And I actually remember the day he was diagnosed. I was working with my grandfather at his house in Coronado, and he got a phone call, and I just remember his eyes got so wide, and I was just
freaked out.
Freaked out, because I was 18. And then I called my cousin and I talked to him, and he was just so hopeless, and everybody else was trying to have all this hope and like, he's gonna live and he's gonna make it. He had stage 4 cancer. Stage 5 is like terminal.
Mm-hmm.
And so he just fought it. He fought it until I came back from the mission. And we spent a couple nights together, you know, here and there, because he lived up in Northern California. I lived in Southern California. Then I went away to college, and he passed away. I was 22. I think he was 22 also, maybe a little bit older.
You said you spent some nights with him talking. What was that like? Like, did he feel like he was going to die? And
yeah,
was it kind of like his insight to, this is what's going to happen here?
Yeah, it was strange to hear a 22-year-old guy with such wisdom, because there was like me that was like, no, dude, you're going to fight this. Like, we're going to make this together. Like, I'm back. Like, I'm sorry I wasn't here. That's a whole nother thing I can't even get into. Maybe we'll do it on another podcast, because that's a hard thing. But I just carry a lot of shame and guilt about like not being there for him, because I left to go on a mission for the church, and that was supposed to be helpful and blah, blah, blah. And it didn't, I don't know if it helped or not. Who knows? Mm-hmm. But I came back. He still died.
But for you, you feel like there. You missed out on that time.
I missed out
time.
On a ton. I missed out on a ton with him. I could have had tons of time with him. Who knows? Maybe I would have gotten into a lot of trouble. Probably what's what happened. Who knows?
But what was some of the wisdom he gave you?
So we were laying there in my house. He was in one bed, I was in another. We were just talking. And I remember him just saying, like, listen, man, like, I know you want me to fight this thing, but I'm not going to live. And it was just brutal.
Yeah.
I just remember thinking, like, there's no way, you know, like.
You're young.
You're 20-something years old. Like, you don't get to die, man. Like, that's not fair. That's wrong. And he was just so, you know, he had accepted it. And he kind of helped me.
I was going to say, oddly enough, helped you accept it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did he have anything that, you know, because I always feel like when people know that they're going to die, they're kind of like, look, this is what I want for you. Or this is what you need to want for you. Or something, you know, where it's, I don't know, something that stands out, or something you always think about when you think of them.
He just always made everybody laugh. He was one of the funniest people you've ever met in your entire life. Like, I wish, because I have all this whole life without him, this long life without him, and I wish people could meet him, because he just, everywhere he went, he had this amazing laugh, and he was the funniest guy. I mean, he was, we would get into so much trouble together, just being fun, just doing dumb
obnoxious
stuff.
Teenagers.
Just because we love to laugh, just because we wanted to laugh.
So he's in the worst time of his life. He knows he's going to die, and he's making you laugh.
He's making us laugh. And that's what he did. And he just kept everyone bright. And he was the guy that would still light up the room, even in his last days. And to this day, one of my biggest regrets is that I wasn't there when he died.
Where were you?
I was in college at a freaking dorm room, you know, like,
yeah, just being a normal,
just being a, like, ignoring it.
Yeah.
I guess, I don't know what else I could have done at that time. I didn't really have the resources to get out there, but
just as you get older, you're like, I wish you never realized that time you missed out.
I should have gone out there and said goodbye. I should have been there in that room when he passed away. And I wish I would have. And now, I mean, I wasn't there, and that sucks. And I think I have a little chip on my shoulder, where I'm just trying to, like, live a little bit for him.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives me energy, you know?
Which is awesome.
Yeah, I think so. Because if he would have lived, he would have done, who knows, he would have done amazing things.
There's nothing wrong, and that's the thing too. I think there's nothing wrong with having someone, you know, on the other side or whatever that you feel like you're living for. Because otherwise it's like that helps give purpose to us when we're here. It's
you
like
know, you know that.
Yeah, it's like you've gotta you wanna make them proud. You want them to be proud of who you are, who you've become because of it.
For sure.
So how soon after Justin passes away.
Yeah, I'm 22 years old. Justin passes away.
And now you've got
24 years old, get Brittany pregnant.
And you've got his mom.
I got his mom who's there.
Who?
She's given us, you know, advice, helping me through it because I didn't know how to tell my family. I didn't know what to do. And so she helped me. She helped me a lot and she got me through one of the toughest things I've ever been because I've never been that alone. Ever, never have been since. I don't know if I ever will be again. I hope I'm never that alone ever again. But that was a dark, dark time.
What was some of the advice that she gave you and Brindy? Because I know that she was important for Brindy too, because it helped her.
She just said, this isn't about anybody else but you. You have to do what's right for you. This is your family now. It started. You've started a family. You didn't mean to. My grandpa came up to us one day when we were down in California after it had kind of like come out that we were having the baby and we were still kind of deciding what to do. And my grandpa, he's like so wise. He pulls us aside and he grabs me and Brindy and he's very intense and very stern. And he looks at both of us. He says, you know what, you guys, it's time for the silliness to be over. You need to decide what you want to do. You need to commit to being together forever,
mm-hmm.
or you need to part ways. And you got to say what you want to do. And it's that simple. And nobody had ever said it like that before. Just so matter of fact. And it was really
clear. Like get in or get out. Like yeah. figure this out. Let's go. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it was this really clear moment. We kind of both looked at each other. And I think in that moment, without saying anything, we both were just like, I think we know what we need to do. And our relationship, as you know, is like the tightest, most intense love in a marriage you could possibly imagine because we went through that really difficult thing. And so that's why we talk about, you know, I talk about finding strength in the suffering moments. Like these dark, dark moments are the things that give me the most meaning and the most purpose and the most drive and the most ability to be able to empathize with people who've also suffered. And that's what I do every single freaking day is I look at people and I see this suffering in their eyes and it is just this deep sorrow that they're experiencing as they lament their life, their choices, their losses, their traumas, and the traumas we're talking about, right? Like every single day I talk with a person about being raped or molested as a child every day without fail.
That would be so hard to hear. That's what I do.
And that's not easy for me, but I don't care because it's way harder for them. And I get my level of suffering and it's great. And so I'm able to take that and just kind of juxtapose it and see that their suffering is so deep and their sorrow is so powerful. And I just sit with them and just look at them and just say, I get it. There's nothing wrong with suffering.
Mm-hmm. Like it's a part of this human experience.
Yeah. Quit ignoring your suffering. I mean, I can tell you how many times a day I say that to people.
Or pushing it aside. Yeah. I feel like that's something we're so good at. Oh, yeah. We're so good at pushing it aside. It's not happening. Nope. If I just ignore it, it totally goes away.
Yeah.
It never goes away.
This wonderful philosopher named Rumi, R-U-M-I, Rumi, said, the cure for the pain is the pain. It's actually on the back of the coin that we give to everybody as they graduate the program that we run up in Draper.
That's so awesome.
Yeah, and that's what it is.
So that's the thing with you and Brindy. It was, you're going through hell. Because I'm sure, you know, I've heard her side. And I know that as much as you were deep, dark, it was rough on her too. So you have all these outside influences, things going that are hard. And you two decide to come together and kind of fight it together. Like, you know, screw everyone else. We're going to do this. We're going to make this happen.
Yeah. I really want to say a bad word right now, but I'm going to. We were basically just like, F the world.
Yeah.
This is me and you. This is me and you, babe. Everybody else can go to hell.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to, you can, you're either with us or yeah. you're not.
If you want to be a part of this? Well, yeah. then join in and bring some positive energy. Otherwise, get the hell out.
Yeah. Because we're going to, like, Brittany and I are weird. Like, we're not in this world to, like, oh, just kind of be here. No, we're here to, like, sorry.
You're going to save the world, Matt. I've already called it.
Yeah, I tell. Yeah, I tell my clients all the time. I say, I don't mess around. You come to my office, you're getting better.
Mm-hmm.
You probably should talk now.
No, I don't. I want you to talk while you're crying. I want everyone to feel what I feel being in the room.
I can't talk.
So here's my thing. So now we've at least heard the gist, right, of your story. At what point, I know you said when you're young, and I know that you wanted to be, you want to help people. You've always wanted to help people. At what point did you say, I'm going to be a therapist?
When I was at Telos with those kids.
Okay. So being around those kids.
I was really good at it. Like, I just naturally just was like gifted. I could sit down with my favorite kids were the kids that everybody else hated, couldn't do anything with. These kids freaked the hell out. So, like, there was one time, Bethany, I walked into a room and I saw this kid, and he was literally, I kid you not, this kid was a cutter. So cutting, some of you may know what cutting is, but basically, mm-hmm. so much pain in your life, the only way
you want to physically feel the pain,
release pain, mm-hmm. is by cutting your arm and watching the blood come out, and there's this euphoric feeling that comes from it.
Mm-hmm.
We had taken all the implements away from this kid. We made him cut his fingernails, and he wanted to cut. And I remember walking into the room, and I walked into this room, and I see this kid on the bed, and he had this crazed look in his eyes, and he was gouging his arm as hard as he possibly could, just raking it, just blood like coming out of the arm from his fingernails. He's just scratching his arm as hard as he could. And I just remember other people, all the other staff members there were looking, and they're like, I don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I know exactly what to do. I'm going in there. I'm going to hug the kid. And I just went in. I hugged him. I grabbed his arm. I didn't let him scratch his arm anymore. And he started crying. He put his hand on my shoulder. And he just started crying. And I just sat there and held him.
So at
that's my gift. That's what I do.
Yeah. And so at that point you're like, this is what I'm doing.
Yeah.
This is how. So tell me, do you have a story? I'm sure you have lots of stories.
I'm full of stories.
I want a story where you said, I mean, was that the time when you're like, this is it, this is what I'm doing? Or when you said, I'm good at this. Like, I connect. I know I can do this. Do you have a story that felt you made as I'm blah, 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 that made you really feel like I can do this? I'm going to do this.
At that Telos place, I was always really good at connecting with the kids. But when I went to grad school, my first year in graduate school, I had an internship and I worked for adult probation and parole, which basically is guys who are drug addicted who are coming out of prison or jail, and they are on probation or parole, and they need therapy. And so I'd be their therapist, and it was free, and it's provided by the state. It's actually a pretty cool program. And I remember sitting with one guy, and therapists hear this all the time, but I felt like this was really genuine. This guy had been in and out of prison his whole life. And he just said, I've never told anybody this before. And he just opened up and he said, when I was, you know, I was 3 years old, I was raped. And it was by my father. And I was for years. And I've never told anybody this.
Oh my gosh.
And I don't know why, but I feel like I can tell you. And I don't know what to do. And I remember thinking, I can do this.
Like, we're gonna help you. You're gonna be better.
And he was despondent and hopeless, and he's a severe heroin addict.
And that's the thing with addiction. You know, it's about 8 in 10 men and 9 in 10 women. The statistics vary. Have childhood trauma, usually rooted in sexual trauma, if you're diagnosed with substance use disorder. Okay. So an addict is kind of the layman's term, but basically you have substance.
That's how they're dealing with their trauma.
Yeah, and that's what they do. And I got that early on. And in the world of addiction, it's people still don't get it. Like even you go to 12-step meetings, they don't talk about that.
Even though that is the root of where this all started.
And so that's why Deer Hollow, where I work now, is like the perfect fit. And Amy, who you guys heard 2 weeks ago, she's like my sister from another mister, mm-hmm. because she thinks the same way I do. And it's all about the root cause, the trauma. And I don't care how awful it is. I want to help these people and I'll listen to it and I'll hear it and I'll sit with them and I'll cry with them and I'll hold them and I'll do whatever it takes. I won't hold them. That's actually an ethical violation.
You really can't do that.
I'll give them a high five. But, you know, I'll hold the space.
Yeah.
And that moment with that guy was definitely a pivotal part of that. Another one, I had this guy who, I just have so many people that they just go into treatment. And I'm not special. There's nothing that I do that's special. But for whatever reason, people connect with me. People open up. And they get better. And they change. And it works. And I feel successful at it. And it gives me great joy. And it gives me great purpose. And I find a lot of meaning in it. And
so here's my next question.
It's awesome.
What made you start this podcast? Because this was 100% your idea. I got a little drug into it. And thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You were not
it.
Reluctant at all.
But
true story. Okay, I'm interrupting here. Mm-hmm. I texted Bethany. I said, hey, I have this cool idea. I want to start a podcast. Do you want to do it? And not, I didn't even hesitate. You're like, yeah, I'm in. What do I got to do?
I did hesitate. Because I was not. Like,
you texted like 2 seconds
I
later.
I asked Kevin and I said, well, because here's the thing. You guys are my best friends. Like, you're some of our best friends. You need help with something? I'm in. Yeah, you know that.
I know.
And so you knew. I felt like you manipulated me. You knew. You're like, Bethany will do. If it's going to help me and my family, she's all in.
No, because you're just good at it.
What did you want to come? Why'd you do this? What did you want to come out of this?
We got to have more people.
So I'm going to tell a little story. The first podcast we did, I was super nervous. I'd been arguing with Kevin all day because I was like, I can't do this. And that's how I react. I just start getting angry and we fight, you know, that's me. So I come into Matt's office and I'm like, I don't know if I can do this. I really don't know if I can handle this. And Matt tells me, he's like, listen, let me tell you some of the things I listen to and hear on a daily basis. And he just told me one story about a girl, and it was a sexually molesting type story. And he's like, that's why we're doing this. He's like, we're going to help people. And I remember thinking right then, I was like, oh my gosh, this isn't about me. This is about everybody else. This is about helping everybody we can. And so I told him, I'm like, okay, let's do it. And we started recording like 2 minutes later, but I was just like, I can't even imagine hearing what you hear. So the fact that you want to turn that into something to help everybody else and give other people tools to handle the stuff they're going through every day. I freaking love it. It's awesome.
Thank you. Thanks for doing this with me.
I know.
Very few people are willing to follow me down my crazy ideas path, but you're one of them. But to answer your question directly, like, people need help, and there's not a whole lot of avenues to get it. Therapy is extremely expensive. Mm-hmm. It's basically reserved for rich white people. Like, let's just call a spade here. That's how therapy works. You want to go to treatment, you got to have insurance. You have to. You have to have a job. Guess who doesn't ever have jobs? Homeless people.
Yeah. The people that don't have money, the people that really need it the most are probably the ones that need it. Yeah.
So this is free. I, you know, and Kevin and I have become super good friends, and we talk a lot about, you know, marketing and what you can do to market yourself. And he's a very successful business person. And what I want to market isn't me. I want to market hope.
Yeah.
And this is free hope.
Yeah. It's 45 minutes to an hour of hope for somebody. And who knows what it'll do? I have no idea. But I love the pebble in the pond analogy. It's the tiniest little pebble can make these massive ripples that can reach the edge of the shore. And we're that little tiny pebble. And who knows who this will affect and who it'll help. And
oh, I'm a podcast, you know, nut. I love them and yeah, I listen to them fantastic. All the time. And my thing is always like, you know, I've said I love to read in the morning or listen to a podcast. Like, what better way to start a day than to hear a story of someone else, maybe that's gone through something hard that gives hope for you, where you're like, oh, I got this. I got this day because I don't have to deal with that. And this person did, and they did. Look how they got through it. I can do this. I'm going to get through this day too.
Yes.
Exactly. That's the point.
Exactly that. Yeah. And so I'm just hopeful. I mean, I guess my story's kind of cool. I don't really know. It's okay. But the more I wanted to tell it, kind of reluctantly, no. So that people can know, like, this is not just this, like, frivolous endeavor.
Yeah. We're not playing around. Fun. No.
No. This, to me, is a big deal. And I want you guys who are listening, I want you to share it. I want you to give it to people. I want you to bring people in. And you know, if you have ideas, we want to hear from you. If you have people who you think that need to be on, like, tell us. Like,
yes.
This is not... I know we're in episode 4 and I'm super grandiose in the way I think about things, but that's why I'm successful, I think. And what do you guys have for us that we need to do? We want to know, because like I said,
well, there's so many people out there that have been through something really hard and they figured out how to overcome it. Oh, everyone should hear that story, because that is important to all of us. We all need to know. And everybody's story matters.
Yeah, we're not going to get huge, massive, famous people on this podcast. It's just not going to happen. That's the point. The point is, you know, you work out next to Sete and you see this dude's deadlift almost 700 pounds. You're like, oh my gosh, that guy's crazy. And then you hear his story and you learn what he does and you're like, whoa, that's amazing. And these people, you live next to them. Who knows what your neighbor does? People's stories blow my mind every day.
They're incredible.
And they need to be heard.
I would say too, so, you know, I'm obviously always a push for therapy because I've seen it in my life make huge changes. But to plug Matt a little bit, Matt was a therapist for my oldest son, and he was having a rough time. I mean, he came to Kevin and I one night just crying and was like, I don't know what to do. I'm so lonely, depressed. I don't know what to do. And he's like, you know, give me some medicine or something, like help me feel better. And so we asked him if he'd go see Matt, and he did. And it took a little while. There was one night that Kevin and I were just in our rooms talking and, you know, getting ready for bed. And he came back from meeting with Matt, which I never knew when he met with Matt, because he has a car. They'd set it up. I wasn't involved other than to, you know, send the payment. But he came into our room and he just started talking to us, and we're like, hey, you know, what's up? What do you, cause he never does that. That's really odd for him. And he just starts talking to us, telling us about his day, and Kevin's like, you know, what prompted this? And he's like, you know, after talking with Matt for the last few months, I just realized I really want to work on the relationships that matter to me, and your relationship matters to me. And I just, like, my heart just, like, melted. And I was like, oh, my God. I'm like, Matt, you gave me my son back.
Thank you.
It was so awesome. Anyways.
He is awesome.
He's such a good kid. He's but when you see your kids hurt, it's awful. So anyways, just so you all know, Matt gave me my kid back. So
thank you.
He's awesome.
Thank you. You're amazing, too.
Okay, you can wrap this up now.
Oh, well, friends, I hope you enjoyed this episode of Finding Strength.
I was not supposed to cry on this one. This was not mine.
That's how it goes. Well, guys, I thank you for listening to my story. And like I said, any feedback you have, please reach out to either Bethany or I.
Yes, thank you very much. We loved I loved hearing Matt's story. I've heard it before, so I just really wanted everyone to hear it because I thought it was incredible. Yeah, I'd finish it off, Matt. If you don't have a therapist, you let us know. And if you don't need or feel like you need a regular therapist, then you listen to this podcast because you will get some free therapy here, I promise. I feel it every time we're here. Also, you know what I'm going to say. Everybody needs to go out and brighten a day.
There you go.
That's how we should start our day. That's how we should end our day. It's awesome.
Brighten a day, people. Thank you for listening. Well, that was fun. Thanks.
Yeah. Everyone got to hear you cry and me cry. Double whammy today.
Double the cry. I guess that makes for a good sit down episode session thing. Who knows? I had fun's probably the wrong word. I'm glad you guys got to hear my story. It'll be a while before you hear it again. I'm much more comfortable in the interviewer's seat. I'll keep getting vulnerable though.
I haven't figured out where I'm comfortable yet.
That's awesome. So, anything you just finish up with?
Yeah, I just want to give a shout out to Brighten a Day. I just want to let people know that's what we do. That is my foundation, and we help families who have lost children, and we help by connection, sometimes financially, sometimes just giving them something that gives them hope and happiness in life. We are a nonprofit organization, and also we have no paid members or no one gets paid. Every single penny you donate to Brighten a Day goes straight to the foundation.
Technically not a nonprofit, you're a charity.
Oh, that's a better word.
Charity, meaning like there's no profit whatsoever, which is true, it's not.
Yeah, nobody gets paid.
But it's a 501c3, so anything you donate to Brighten a Day goes directly to families who've lost children.
Yes.
So click the donate button, brightenaday.org. Me, hit me up on Facebook, Matt Quackenbush, MSW. Hit me up on my website, MatthewQuackenbush.com. I have blog posts on there, articles that I've written, and some have been published in different places. So you can check me out there. And if you want to reach out to me, you can hit me up through Messenger. And if you need a therapist and you're in the Utah area, please come see me. I would love to work with anybody who is ready to take that step and change their life, because I guarantee it will be well worth your time. For sure, for sure.
Yeah. And also, I love how interactive you guys have been so far. When Matt kind of announces on Facebook who we're going to meet with, I love hearing the questions and your thought process, because sometimes when we're sitting in here, if it's just our own questions, I feel like it doesn't reach as many people. When we can get questions and thoughts from other people, it really helps to get it out there and help, you know, get the attention and the help for as many people as we can.
For sure. We appreciate everything you guys have done for us. Feedback, support, getting it out there. We love our audience, our listeners. You guys are fantastic. Thank you.
Yes. And if there's any stories that need to be told or you guys want to be heard, let me know. Thanks, you guys.